Good morning. Jesus was born around 4 BC, somewhere between 6 and 4 BC. It was a fascinating time in human history. It was also a violent time. It was also a time of some hopefulness, believe it or not, among Romans. In fact, even around the world. I want to read something to you. Quote, "There is a new order of the ages. A new human race is descending from the heights of heaven. The birth of a child with whom the iron age of humanity will end and the golden age begin." Isn't that interesting? Almost as if it were spoken of Jesus, but it wasn't. Those words were not spoken about Jesus. Those were words from the Roman prophet, or not prophet, poet. I guess poets are prophets sometimes. The Roman poet Virgil. And rather than speaking about Jesus, he was speaking about Caesar Augustus, who was the king, who was the emperor, and the first to found the emperor cult of Rome, the worship of the emperor. In fact, Augustus's name had been Octavius when he was a general. And when he became Caesar, he changed his name to Augustus, which means majestic. And indeed, they believed he was majestic. They wrote songs to him. They literally worshipped this man, Caesar Augustus. The odd thing is that at the time that he was at the height of his power, which was when he was about 60 years old, a baby was born in a dusty, musty, useless, troublesome corner of his empire over in Palestine. And as important as Caesar Augustus thought he was, and as a matter of fact, as important as he was to the people, he was nothing compared to that child, a child he never even knew, a child who would grow to be Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ. If Augustus thought he was important, just think of the fact that that baby that Augustus didn't even know about would grow to be a man at whose life we would date the rest of human history. It's interesting, isn't it, how the things that we think are important often turn out not to be. Have you ever read old newspapers and the old headlines from newspapers that grasped everyone's attention at the time? Do you ever tear down an old house and find out that they were insulating with old newspapers? Do you ever have that? And you read all these old yellow newspapers and you see all the stuff that was important however many years ago. Well, actually, you don't even have to go that far back. You can read a newspaper from a few weeks ago and find out what we thought was going to be important and then discover that today it's just old news. There's nothing older than yesterday's news. It's really not that important, with a few exceptions, of course, you know, the beginning of World War II, the end of World War II, and various other things that are collector newspapers. The fact of the matter is, a lot of what humans think is important turns out not to be so important. And even when it does appear to be important at the time in world history, on the stage of world history, is it really? I think of Caesar, and I think of all the importance that he had for himself. I think of all the people who are trying very hard to be important, and how important it is for them to feel important and to have other people think they're important. Do you think that's important? Oh, but I'm unimportant, so I must not matter. See, the funny thing is, when you think about it, you look at the story of Jesus, the God-man, it really turns everything we think and feel upside down. And that was part of the reason that he came. One of the reasons he came was to teach us that we do not think like God thinks. And that which is important to us not only may not be important to him, it may actually be the opposite. It may be something horrible to him. As we look into the life of Jesus Christ, I'd like you to turn with me to Matthew chapter 2, where we get a glimpse of Jesus as a baby somewhere between 2 months and 20 months old. These are among the passages, as we've seen last week, at last couple times, matter of fact, they're among the passages that people usually read at Christmas time. And you'll notice in Matthew chapter 2, a very familiar story. The first half of Matthew 2 is repeated at Christmas time. The second half is not, for obvious reasons. The second half is not happy. The first half is. But what we discover in this is the importance of Jesus and the choice-making that goes on. I'll tell you ahead of time what's happening here. The first half of Matthew chapter 2 is the visit of some very interesting characters who we're going to meet. And then the second half of chapter 2 of Matthew is the decision made by another interesting and really horrible character on behalf, actually, of the Jewish leaders, believe it or not, with regard to Jesus. In both cases, there's a decision involved, and I want us to remember that. Remember that all your decisions are based on what you really believe is important, okay? Yes, they are. They're all based on what you really believe is important. You say, well, no, I sometimes make decisions because I'm forced to. Yeah, but that's because you believe it's important to respond to the force that tells you to make that decision, okay? You always make decisions based on what's important to you, and so do I. It's the nature of being a human being. And we're going to notice in both of these characters that decisions are made. And as we read through it, I want us to be thinking, what would I do? How would I be? What would I be like if I were in this account? Now, the background is, of course, that Jesus is, like I said, a couple of months, between 2 months and 20 months old. It's a broad spectrum in there, but we're just really not sure. And the year is about 4 BC. Augustus is on the throne. His friend Herod, who is close to 70 and is about 10 years older than Augustus, is on the throne of Israel. Joseph and Mary have settled in Bethlehem for at least a little while. They didn't move immediately to Nazareth, apparently. They stayed in Bethlehem for a little while, perhaps until the baby was a little stronger. And during that period of time, while they were there, these events took place. It's actually one event, but on the other hand, there's these two sets of characters involved in it. So let's begin in Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard it, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Let me explain this as we go along. The Magi, we get our word magic, by the way. This is a Persian word. It comes into Greek as magoi, but it refers to a group of people from Persia, which is present-day Iran, by the way. And they had a caste of people. They had a type of individual who were a cross between philosophers and scientists and religionists. They were all of the above, and they were preeminently astrologists. They looked into the heavens, and they would gauge by the heavens what was going to happen. They were quite scientific about the movement of the stars, and capable of all kinds of calculations based on the movement of the stars. And in their religious background, they believed that the stars influenced humanity, which, of course, we know is not true. God influences humanity, but nevertheless, ancient peoples often worshiped the stars. That's the kind of person this was. These magoi, magi. Okay, we got our word magic from it. But they weren't really magicians in the sense that we say doing tricks, and that wasn't it. They were wise. They were not kings. There were not three of them. There were probably up to 100 in their entourage. They were not anything from the song, "We Three Kings of Orient." I always wondered what Orientar was. Did you ever, when you were a kid, when you sang that song? "We Three Kings from Orientar." I always wondered. I looked on the map, never found it. They're from the Orient in a sense. That was the way that the Middle East was spoken of at the time the song was written. But if you take your theology from songs and from cards, you're going to get the wrong picture of these men. They were men to be reckoned with. They were very important, though they were not kings. They were probably as important as kings in their culture. And we don't know a whole lot more about them than that, other than what I've told you. But they saw a star. Now, again, people say, well, where's this? What star? What star did they see? Was it a conjunction? There was a conjunction, by the way, of three stars. Two, Jupiter and Saturn, lined up to make a really bright-looking spot in the sky in 7 BC. We know that from guys who study the stars today can tell you where they were in 7 BC. And it would have been visible three times, as a matter of fact, during that year. And at one point, a year later, Mars joined the group and lined up and would have caused And this is all during that period of time when Jesus was born, or roughly right in there. So people speculate, well, maybe that was it. Maybe it was a conjunction. The planets have aligned. It's the age of Aquarius. No. The planets have aligned, and, you know, maybe that's what... By the way, that age of Aquarius stuff dates clear back into Babylonia and Persia, and it is the fruit of the same root system these people did. You know, all of that, all the astrology. At any rate, maybe, was it an alignment of planets that God specifically set up so these guys would see it and say something important's going to, who knows, it doesn't say. Was it just a supernatural thing in the sky? Could be. Some people think that's just what it was. The Lord said, I need these guys over here, do something with them. I'm gonna make a big spot in the sky, and they're going to go, wow, a spot in the sky. We better follow it, and they will. They'll come over here. Well, who knows? Nobody really knows what it was. We do know one thing. The Lord wanted them there. Now, there was a sizable Jewish community in Persia and in Babylon, by the way. And it's entirely possible that these people, these magi, had some contact with Jews and the Jewish scriptures and Jewish mysticism. They may have been influenced. They were influenced by lots of things. They may very well have been influenced by these things. And they may have understood a little bit, a tiny bit, about the coming of a king, because they call him the King of the Jews. And where did they get that idea? That he was the King of the Jews and he was born at this time and this special thing was happening. There's a lot of mysteries around these guys. And like I said, they would be coming in, traveling, and they would cause quite a stir. They would come to the gates. They did not go to Herod first. They came to the gates. The gates of the city were large. There were a lot of rooms in them and stuff, big, huge walls. And that's where all the important guys of the town hung out. There was always a representative there that could answer directions and give you directions, answer questions for the city, and so on. This is probably where the Magi came at first. And they get off the camel, you know, and they walk in. I say, excuse us, has there been an important child born hereabouts? Because we saw a star, and we're following it, and this is where it should be happening. A child born? I haven't heard about a child being born. A king of the Jews? The king of the Jews is Herod. He's up in his palace. But a baby king we just don't know about. But the word got back to Herod. You know, it just kind of goes through the town. Go tell Herod. Go tell Herod that there's a baby. And these guys are important-looking guys. And they're here, and they want to talk to somebody about a baby. So Herod was troubled. And then it says, all Jerusalem was troubled with him. Now the reason is not because Jerusalem was worried about the Magoi or that they were worried about a child being born. They were worried because Herod was worried. Herod was a brutal, violent man. He was in the last year of his life. He was about 70. He died within a few months of these events. And he had made a career, a brutal career, as a leader of Israel under the Romans. He was a client king under the Romans and a friend of Augustus. That's actually how he remained in power, as a friend of Augustus. And so when he was mad, when he got upset, you wanted to literally hold your head and make sure it stayed exactly where it was, because the heads would roll. He would have people executed, you know, cut your head off so fast you wouldn't know it till you sneeze, is the way we used to say it when we were studying these things. That's the way he was. He was kind of a madman. He got worse because he was sick. Some people think with venereal disease by the time he died. But at this point, he's a frightening man. And so if Herod is wringing his hands, the whole city is wringing their hands. They're thinking, ooh, don't upset Herod, okay? So that's why it says that Jerusalem was troubled. So Herod, he hears about these things, and he gathers together all the chief priests and the scribes and the people. Scribes of the people. Now these are, the chief priests were the Sadducees, they were the political ones. The scribes were mostly Pharisees, and they were experts in the law. They were theologians. They were experts in the Torah. And he got the highest ones together that he could find. And he had a relatively simple, man, it was a really simple question for these guys. And I'm surprised Herod himself didn't know it, but he didn't know the Bible, of course. He only pretended to. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he didn't really know. He said, where's the Christ going to be born, the Messiah? Well, immediately, he's connected. A king of the Jews, born, hereabouts, and he immediately knows, uh-oh, this could be a Messiah. And this is trouble for him. He's extremely jealous of his throne. And so he said, where's the Messiah supposed to be born? Well, they knew immediately. And they quoted Micah 5:2. They said, in Bethlehem of Judea, it's been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah. For out of you shall come forth a ruler who will be shepherd of my people Israel. So they quoted it to him. They said, well, that's a simple question. Any one of us could have answered that. It's in Bethlehem. So then Herod secretly called the Magi, verse 7, and ascertained from them the time of the star appeared. So he goes back out. He finds these guys. He brings them into his private quarters or something. He says, come on. Now, when did you say you first found that star? You saw that star up in the sky? Well, 2 years ago. 2 years ago. Really? Well, now the question was it 2 years ago that Jesus was born and the star appeared at the moment he was born? Or did the star appear earlier? This is a question we might be asking in order to get the guys there in time, because it apparently took them quite a while to get that far, thousands of miles from where they were living, and get their act together and move all the way up there. We don't really know. That's why we figured Jesus was somewhere between 2 months and 20 months. We don't know when the star actually appeared with relation to the birth of Jesus, but we do know it was for the purpose of getting him there. So he says, when was it? Well, they said about 2 years ago. So he's calculating in his mind, see? He's thinking, well, that means that this baby is no more than 2 years old. And that's a good piece of information for Herod, which he's going to use in a little while. He says, well, you go make careful search for the child. And when you found him, you report to me, and I want to come and worship him too. Aw. It's because he likes babies. What a soft-hearted guy old Herod was, huh? This is child's play for him. You say, well, that's pretty conniving. That is nothing. If you know anything about Herod's history, and I'm going to give you a little bit of Herod's history this morning, this is nothing to him. This is all this is before coffee break, first thing in the morning. He'd lie to 20 people before his breakfast. He was just right in his element. He says, you go find all about that, and then you come back and you tell me where this baby is, and I'm going to go take him presents too. Okay? Yeah, fine. They don't know anything going on until after they get to Bethlehem. Having heard the king, verse 9, they went on their way, and lo, the star, which they had seen in the east, went on before them until it came and stood over where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Apparently, it wasn't there during the period of time they were asking questions in Jerusalem. And did you ever ask yourself why they went to Jerusalem first? Why the Lord didn't put the star over Bethlehem in the first place and just save the trouble of going to Jerusalem? Don't you think sometimes God is inefficient about how he gets things done? Now, come on. Don't look at me like that. You guys, don't you think that? At times, don't you think, Lord, it would have been a lot easier for you to just give him a star over somebody's head that I was supposed to talk to? Or, you know, make this happen in an easier way. Well, there actually is a reason for this, which I'll tell you. But before I do, remember, God never does anything for no reason. He always has a reason for literally everything. He's not running around like we are with our day runners just trying to keep so many plates spinning that we can hardly keep track. That's not the way he works. Every single thing he does has a reason. There's a purpose. At any rate, the purpose for this was to let the Jewish people, the Jewish leadership know, and that's why Matthew puts it in the account. The Jews needed to know something had happened. Now, God does not show them his whole hand. He never does. He never does. But he shows them enough that they will be responsible, and Matthew puts it in here on purpose because Matthew's drawing a distinction. He's drawing a comparison between these two types of people, these Gentile Magoi and the Jewish leaders. That's why the story is constructed this way and why Matthew puts it in. So it's important that they come there first. The Jewish leadership needed to be put on notice in this rather sly way. It's a rather sidelight kind of a way that they're put on notice. So there's the star. They find the house. Verse 11. They came into the house. They saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. And opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. This is where we get the idea that there were three of them, because there were three gifts. And so, you know, it made nice for the song. But there weren't just three of them, and this was just the type of gift that they brought, that's all. They brought this, and they probably brought a lot of it, and probably a bunch of other stuff too. Can you imagine Mary in this house with a two-month-old baby, and all the other things that had already happened, and the angels talking to her, and the whole thing? I mean, and then to have these odd-looking Gentile Persian types come in, you know, with their big whole entourage. They would have, like, filled little Bethlehem. Like, Bethlehem was not a big town. And after the census was taken and everybody was dispersed, it went back to its normal little population. Can you imagine the stir? And everybody's over, what's happening down at Joseph and Mary's place? You know, they rented this place for a little while, you know. What an exciting moment. Mary's holding the baby. These guys come in. The baby, the star. Mary's going, I thought it was kind of bright out last night, you know. Do you ever wonder what it would have been like, these moments? Anyway, they bring in this gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These were gifts for a king, certainly. You know what gold is. Frankincense was incense, very, very pure incense, and they burned it by putting hot coals on a brass plate, and then they would sprinkle incense, powdered incense, over the coals. They didn't do it in sticks hanging over the kitchen sink, like is so often done today, the traditional way. Instead, they and light it with a lighter, you know, they didn't do that. They had coals out of the fire, they sprinkle this powder on there, and then it would whoosh, and it would come up and fill the house with beautiful smell. And the more expensive the incense, of course, the more important you were. And so a king would have real expensive incense. Now, they used incense, by the way, in worship. But they also, in day-to-day life, they used incense to cover all the other rather unappetizing smells that were involved in life in the first century. And so the air was thick. It was thick with a sweet smell very often because of incense. But this frankincense was used mostly in worship because it was so expensive. They used the most expensive things in worship, which is a lesson in itself, but I'm not going to go into that. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh was a liquid perfume that they got from underneath the bark of trees in Arabia. And the trees have, the name of the tree has so many syllables, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. But they would slash the bark and the sap would dribble out and it was so sweet smelling. They would use it and mix it with other oils and create perfume out of it. Very, very expensive stuff. And that's what they brought to the child. And they left all this here with Joseph and Mary and they worshipped this child. Well then, I mean, the scene is quite impressive. And then, verse 12, having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed for their own country by another way. They had gone down the back of the hills to the Judean wilderness and across the top of the Dead Sea, the northern boundary of the Dead Sea, and back east again. And the Lord simply said, don't go back to... They'd already done what he wanted him to do, which was to put Herod on notice about these things, and to see if the Jewish leaders would say or do anything if someone mentioned that the Messiah might have been born, which is very interesting because they didn't. And they say, why would Matthew put this here? You guys, this is very odd. It doesn't seem odd to us because we are used to Christmas, and we think, well, what would Christmas be like without the three wise men? But that's because of our tradition. We're used to it. If you really just take all that away and look at the story that Matthew puts together of what, this is a very Jewish gospel. It's got the Jewish genealogies. It's got all the fulfilled scriptures. He's talking to the Jews about the Messiah. This gospel, the Matthew gospel, is really very, very Jewish. What are these Gentiles doing in the second chapter? Why? And they're not just any old Gentile. These are not God-fearers. They're not Gentiles who converted to Judaism, which is the normal kind of Gentile that you'd run into under those circumstances. These guys are Persian astrologers, for Pete's sake. They're weird by spiritual standards. They're odd. They're mystics. They come out of the fog. They show up on the scene. They worship the Messiah. They go back into the fog. We never hear about them again. And we don't even know if they're really converted. People say, well, they must have been Christians. We don't. It doesn't say that. It just said that they knew that Jesus was so important they should come and bow down to him, do obeisance to him. They may have been converted. Who knows? There was a big Jewish contingent there in Persia. Maybe they planted the seed that was watered years later after the resurrection of Christ when people went to that area and preached the gospel, because they did. They went to Persia and preached the gospel. And many people came to Christ in those next 100 years. Maybe these guys went and planted that seed. We don't know. It's very odd that they're here because they're Gentiles. But on the other hand, maybe it's not so odd because what Matthew's getting at and the reason he tells a story about Jesus the way he does is to show us somebody was interested in Messiah, even if it wasn't the people who should have been. And that's why he puts it here. You see, one of the interesting things about Jesus is how interested the Gentiles have always been in him and how disinterested Israel has always been in him. And Matthew makes a point of it right here in the very beginning. And it's a recurring theme throughout history to the point where Christianity today is seen as a Gentile religion. It isn't really. It's Jewish to the core. The root system of Christianity is in Judaism. It's not a Gentile religion. Read Romans, if you don't believe me. Romans 11 makes it real clear. And yet, the Jews were not interested in their Messiah. And that's part of what Matthew is saying as he writes this. See, look at these weird, bizarre guys from Persia. They're more interested in Messiah than the Jews. That's why he puts it. So then we find out not only were Jews not interested, they were threatened. And Herod is very threatened. Now, when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Arise, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." So he arose and took the child and his mother by night, departed for Egypt. And he was there until the death of Herod, probably several months, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled. And he quotes Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. "Out of Egypt did I call my son." Very interesting, because if you read Hosea 11, 1, it's not about the Messiah. It's about Israel, Old Testament Israel coming out of Egypt. And that's obviously what the passage is about. But you see, here's the connection. Jesus fulfills Old Testament Israel. He is the fulfillment. He said, "I am the vine," that Old Testament vine. He says, "That's me." And that's what you have to remember. Remember that Egypt was so important. Just a little sidelight here. Egypt was so important to Israel. It was where Abraham went when he needed help. Remember, he ran to Egypt. It was where Jacob took the tribes, the patriarchs, when they had a famine. They went to Egypt. And Joseph was already there, and he had set up all of the food. Egypt was a safe place that God used to protect Israel. They grew there. And then when they were ready to come out, he brought them out. And Jesus fulfills all of that. He is the fulfillment of the type. So that's why, take him to Egypt. It's the perfect picture in the new covenant of what happened in the old. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the Magi. Outsmarted, outwitted, actually, the word means. And he is enraged. Didn't take much to send him into a rage. And he sent and he slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its environs from 2 years old and under, according to the time when he had ascertained from the Magi. This probably would have been between 10 and 20 little ones that he killed. You say, what a horrible atrocity. You know what's really horrible is that in Herod's career, this was not by any means the most horrible atrocity and would not have been considered so even by the Romans. Isn't that terrible? That's what's really horrible. First of all, they did not value babies. They did not value human life. They valued political power. The Romans did, and Herod did. And that's why they got along so well. Let me tell you a little bit about Herod. It'll maybe give you a little insight into why it is that he could do such a horrible thing. Herod, when he took over, he was about 70 when these things took place. But when he took over Israel, some 40 plus years before this, when he took over as king of Israel, the first thing he did was kill half the Sanhedrin. Just kill them outright. They had opposed him coming in. Herod was not Jewish. He married into the Jewish, married into the Hasmoneans, who were the Maccabees. He married one of their daughters. And what happened was, he understood, because he was Edomite. He was an Edomite. So if you know a little about your geography, you know a little about your history, you know that the Edomites were the descendants of Esau, and there was no real love between the Edomites and the Jews. Herod was an Edomite, and he married into the Hasmonean family, became politically powerful, took over as king, and began a ruthless reign as king through all of his years. He married 10 times, I think looking for a woman who would like him. If you read his story and you see how many kids he fathered, and you try and make a chart of Herod's family life, it makes you crazy. I'm not kidding you. It's just a jumble of lines if you try and make a chart. He had a life, a family life, like a bad soap opera. Everybody was marrying each other. Everybody was trading wives. He himself got tired of one wife. His first wife was Doris, and he got tired of her because he found a new wife named Miriam, who was really beautiful. And so he sent Doris off to Egypt with her son and got rid of him and married Miriam, and it was Miriam that actually revealed something very important about him, and she became very much the problem. His passion for her was utterly ungovernable. He, both in anger and in love, Herod was almost insane. And at one point, because he had to keep track of the Caesars and stay working for him, he had been a friend of Antony and Cleopatra. If you guys know a little bit of history, he had been a friend of Antony's. and had worked under Antony when Antony ran the eastern part of the empire. And in the war between Antony and Octavian, he had taken Antony's side. In fact, he even collected an army to go and help Antony. He never got there in time, but he collected the army to go help Antony. When Antony lost, and Antony and Cleopatra went back to Egypt and eventually committed suicide, Herod felt a little out in the cold. In those days, the way they changed kings was kill the old one, bring in the new one. So he knew he had to do something to make friends with Octavian. Octavian had won. Octavian became Augustus. He was going to be the emperor that everyone would worship. So here's what he did. This will make sense in just a minute. If you're not interested in history, just hang with me. Because understanding Herod is an important thing. What he did was, he knocked off a couple guys, which is what he almost always did. Anywhere he went, anytime he went anywhere, he just had to get rid of a couple enemies. And then, as he was leaving, he thought, you know what? Octavian might not buy my rap. I have a big pile of money. I'm going to take him. But he might not buy my rap that I'm going to be loyal to him. In case he doesn't, and he takes my head off of my shoulders, I love Miriam so much, I cannot imagine her being married to anybody else. So he left secret orders to have her killed if he was killed by Octavian. Now, this kind of intrigue was not uncommon in Herod's household. Not uncommon at all. Well, he went to Octavian, and Octavian liked him and realized he was the only guy who could handle the Jews because he acted Jewish when he was with the Jews and he knew their history. But he was really a Gentile at heart, so he could get along with the Romans. Octavian wanted to use him for that. So he said, great, you're the king. And that's how Herod the Great became Herod the Great. That's how he became the king under Augustus. But when he got back, the word had slipped. And Miriam knew that he had put the order to kill her if he was killed. So when he returned, she was utterly incensed at him. But she was convinced that he would never leave her because she knew he was absolutely intoxicated with her. He was absolutely impassioned by her. So she railed on him and abused him day and night, not realizing that behind the scenes, his sister Salome, not the one with John the Baptist, but another one, and several others were encouraging him to get rid of Miriam. After a year of this abuse and a year of this political stuff behind the scenes, he contrived a phony charge of adultery and had her executed. And then he had her mother executed. And this was the beginning, not the beginning, he was bad before this, but he began to degenerate horribly. He remained a king. He built a lot of good stuff in Israel. He was very important, well-connected. But from then on, those sins, those crimes, he never really recuperated from them. In his career, his friend Augustus, said, I'd rather be his pig than his son. And that rhymes in Greek. He said, I'd rather be his pig than his son because it'd be safer. He killed three of his sons. His brother-in-law, at the age of 17, he had drowned. He had his other two sons strangled because he thought they were a threat to his throne. Just before he died, he had his final son executed. From his deathbed, he couldn't move. This is after the events of killing these babies. He, from his deathbed, ordered the execution of his final son, Miriam's only son, had him executed. And then he thought to himself, get this. He thought to himself, nobody's going to grieve when I die. Duh. So he tells his sister Salome, I want you to make sure that there's some grieving that happens in this country when I die. And here's how I want you to do it. I want you to invite all the nobles from the country here to Jericho. That's where he was recuperating at a spa in Jericho. I want you to have them come here, and when they come, you arrest them. Put them in the hippodrome and arrest them. And when I die, you execute all of them so that everybody is crying in this country when I die. I want there to be grief when I die. Can you believe that? Well, he died of a loathsome, horrible disease I won't describe to you because it is too gross to describe, that he had probably had for some time. And probably had some venereal disease as well. And after he died, everybody looked at each other and said, he's dead. We don't have to do what he said. So they didn't. And they didn't kill those guys. But you can see what kind of a man Herod was. So this is very much in keeping with him. And as a matter of fact, it's not the worst thing that he did. As horrible as it is, this was just in a day's work for Herod. Let me ask you something. I told you a story about Miriam, right? You tell me, did he love Miriam? Who did he love? Himself. We learn a lesson from Herod. And it's easy to fool ourselves and say, well, I love so-and-so so much, when what we really love is what so-and-so does for us. Or the reflection, our own reflection in their eyes, that's what we love. And the way you can tell if you're radically, deeply, profoundly, sweetly committed to yourself is you think this way. If I can't have them, nobody can have them. Whether it's a child, or a spouse, or a car. I had to put that in there because some guys love their cars like as much as the others. Or whatever it may be. And we say, well, it's love. It's this love I have for this. No, it's not. It's love for the self. And that's why I told you all that stuff about Herod, you guys, because it's important. And as we tie this together, you'll see Herod is a type of person that is still around today. Well, after Herod was dead, behold, the angel came and appeared to Joseph, verse 19. He said, take the child and his mother, go back to the land of Israel. The one who sought the child's life, all who sought the child's life are dead. He arose and took the child and his mother and came to the land of Israel. And when he heard that Archelaus, that was Herod's son, was reigning over Judea, actually it was divided. The kingdom was divided into three. Three of his sons who survived, who didn't get killed, took over. And one of them was Archelaus. He ruled over Judea. In place of his father Herod, Joseph was afraid to go there. And being warned by God in a dream, he departed to the regions of Galilee, back up to Nazareth, see, verse 23, and came and resided in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken through the prophet might be fulfilled, he shall be called a Nazarene. So there's three Old Testament quotes in which Jesus fulfills these things and finally ends up exactly where God the Father wants him. Just a sidelight here before we move into the application section. Just a little freebie. Did you notice how it appears that the Lord is basically just barely one step ahead of the enemy here? It's almost like the enemy is just trying to step on an ant, you know, that's getting away from you, you know, and you're not quite, or a spider, they move real quick, and you try and step on them, and he's like one step ahead of death. You know something? That was true of Jesus. He was one step ahead of death for most of his life. The enemy was after him from the moment he was born. And this was clear. It was a dangerous world into which he was born. But what I want you to notice is how God could have made it easier, but he didn't. Did you notice that? He could have made it a lot easier, but he didn't. And you know, sometimes he doesn't make our lives easier either. In fact, as I say, don't you feel like someone's after you and just barely missing you? Sometimes you just actually do feel that way. And you say to yourself, Lord, how could you be at work in a life where some things like this have gone wrong? I feel like I'm making it up as I go. It's almost an accident that I'm still here. Almost an accident. I have no answer for why God does it this way, but all I can tell you is he does very often do things in ways that we cannot comprehend and make us feel as if he's not in control. But you'll notice in the story, because we see some things behind the scenes, he's in control all the way along. So if your life feels out of control, take a lesson from this. There are things you do not see, in which God is not doing things efficiently by our estimation. But to accomplish all that he wants to accomplish, these things need to take place. And that's what happened here. Until finally Jesus was back in Nazareth. Now, I want to close with just a couple thoughts. This whole account reminds us of some things. It's not about Jesus as much as it is about people around him. That's where the application is. So let me mention three things that come out of the passage. Number one, those who knew the most cared the least. Did you notice that? And that's why Matthew puts it in. The Jews knew exactly where Messiah was to be born. They didn't lift a finger. Bethlehem was 5 miles away, maybe seven. They hear that this thing may have happened, there may be Messiah born. They don't even bother to go over there and check it out. On the other hand, you've got the Magoi, these weird guys from Persia, these Gentiles, and they hear, they travel 2 years, thousands of miles, hundreds of people in the entourage make all this effort just to come to worship for a very short period of time, just to see the child. And Matthew says, in essence, look at the contrast. Let me ask you something. How much do you know about God? And does it really matter? It's an interesting thing how familiarity with the things of God can actually breed contempt. Knowing a lot of details about him isn't the same as walking with him, not the same as having a passion for him, not the same as wanting to love him with all your heart. Knowledge of the prophecies, knowledge of eschatology, these guys had all of that. They had their theology. But when it came to going the 5 miles to find out if Messiah was there, they wouldn't lift a finger to do it. Those who knew the most cared the least. And I have found this to be a danger among Christians. So if you're a Christian, my pastoral advice is, if you get a hardening of the arteries spiritually, you need to go back to the Lord and say, Lord, whatever it takes, start me over. Whatever it takes, I want to love you. I don't want to lose my knowledge, but I want my knowledge to mean something. I want it to prompt me to pursue you. I sometimes would rather, as a pastor, it's easier to talk to a person who is a rank pagan who's even arguing with me about who Jesus is. If it's an honest argument, I'd rather have an honest argument with a rank pagan than play this little fencing game that you end up playing with backslidden Christians sometimes, where you spar with jargon. Tink, 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 tink. You spar with the jargon, you know. You just say, well, the Lord did this and that, and you keep talking, but you're talking around the edges because the person doesn't want to deal with the Lordship of Jesus at all. And you know it. It's easier just to deal with a straightforward pagan like a Magoi, these weird guys. I talked with, not a Magoi, he was a Jewish scholar, who is not a Christian, but he understood a lot about Jesus. He had made a study of Jesus' life. And we had a wonderful conversation. I didn't convert him. I didn't try. I just told him what I knew of Jesus, and he told me what he knew, and we talked on an airplane. It was fascinating. It was, in my opinion, a real productive conversation. I don't know where you are. I don't know how long you've been a Christian. I don't know how tired you are as a Christian. But if your faith is old, it could be strong and old, and that would be good. But if it's dry and brittle and old, then, my friend, get back to it. Get back to it, because one of the lessons here is that these people had a very old faith, but it was dead as a doornail. There was no real passion, no real desire to walk with God in it. Rededicate your life to the Lord. Second thing you notice is, those who had the power sensed a threat. That was Herod, of course, and all the Jewish leaders, and this chased Jesus all his life. The people who hated Jesus the most were the ones who had the most to lose if Jesus was Lord. Because indeed he is. And anybody who wants to be sovereign over their own life is going to have a real problem with Jesus. Because when you come to Jesus, you take your crown off and you hand it to him. Interesting, that's what Herod did with Augustus. He literally took his crown in his hand and handed it to Augustus when he wanted Augustus to make him king. He went there and he took the crown off, he handed it to Augustus, and he said, I will do whatever you say. But he knew he couldn't do that with Messiah, so he tried to kill him. One thing that Herod understood clearly, and all the Jewish leaders did as they attacked Jesus, and you'll see it as we work through his life. They knew there can only be one sovereign, there can only be one king, and they knew if Jesus is who he says he is, then I have to bow the knee, and I don't want to. Be aware that when you give your life to Jesus, he really is the Lord, and you're taking your crown off and handing it to him. And if you think it's anything other than that, don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. If you think it's anything other than saying, Lord, here's my life, here's my crown, I will not be sovereign over my life, you will. If you think that coming to Jesus is anything less than that, think again. Herod understood it, and we learned kind of like a backwards lesson from him because of that. He knew that, he figured this was a threat. And so instead of saying, I will obey, he tried to kill him. And ultimately, you find yourself in Herod's camp if that's the course you take. And that brings me to the third thing. Those who heard about him had to make a decision, and that's true today too. Always, always true. You can't hear about Jesus and not be challenged to make a decision. The Magoi heard about him, and they made their decision, invested a lot of money and time, traveled all the way to Israel to worship. Herod heard about him. He made his decision, made the order to have him killed, or try to have him killed. Jesus said, jot it down. Jesus said in Matthew 12, verse 30, if you're not with me, you're against me. And if you're against me, you're going to scatter. He said that. Now you do not, that's not on Christmas cards either. I don't know. There's just these lines that are not there, you know, sometimes that we just don't use very often. But he makes people choose. And my word to you this morning is choose. Choose. Fish or cut bait. You are one of these guys. You're either going to worship or you're going to go after him. One or the other. I am absolutely convinced that's why Matthew put it in here. I think that's why this story is here. And it's what we need to learn. Let's bow our heads. Father, we love you. And I pray for the hearts of anyone here this morning who hasn't given their life to Jesus, who's been struggling, kicking the tires, running around the edges, and who may be deeply, deeply, profoundly committed to the self, like Herod. I know I was, Lord, and in fact, all of us were. And I just pray for him, Lord. Anybody hearing these words for whom that's true. I pray that you'd break through with your love and your grace, and that you would change their lives this morning, that they'd give their hearts and minds to you. And we who belong to you, and some of us are second, third, maybe even fourth generation Christians, some of us have been Christians longer than, literally longer than we can remember. Father, preserve us from knowing so much that our love wanes, becomes too complex. We can't be bothered with simple devotion to you. Deliver us from this. We thank you for the difficulties of our lives, which actually are a form of deliverance in this way and force us to our knees. We pray that you would fill us with your Spirit. Teach us to come. In Jesus' name.